This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me. Right now, you like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich, and I'm here today with a returning guest and interviewer on Little Gold Men, our colleague, Johanna Desta. Hello, Johanna.
Hey, Katie. Nice to be back.
So for this interview episode today, you and I talked to people behind two of the biggest movies of 2022 as we kick off 2023. So first, let's hear the conversation you had with Angela Bassett, who sort of needs no introduction, but really has, she's tremendous in Black Panther Wakanda Forever, even more so than in the first one. It's kind of a thing where she was a key player in this ensemble in Black Panther, but she steps up into an even bigger role and really emotional one in Wakanda Forever. And I'm assuming you guys got into that.
Yeah, absolutely. I was so curious to know what it was like for her being the center of a story in a way that she hadn't quite been in the first Black Panther. And she told me so many stories about the set. And it was great. She's an icon, to put it mildly. So it was a pleasure to chat with her.
Yeah. And like when Wakanda Forever came out, we were kind of like, oh, well, you know, she's really great at it, but we'll see how she lasts in the supporting actress race. But she keeps getting nominated for things. And it's been 30 years since her first Oscar nomination for What's Love Got to Do with It. I think many of us would agree that she is way overdue for another recognition. I'm not sure if you got her to agree to that, but I assume you're right there with me on that.
Oh, I'm absolutely right there with you on that. If she's nominated, she would be the first, I think, actor in a Marvel Cinematic Universe film to be nominated for an acting performance. And I did ask her a little bit about what it was like to be hearing all the Oscar buzz for this performance, because she really is amazing in it. She just holds center stage and she has so many knockout scenes. So it's only normal that the Oscar conversation would get started for her.
Of course. Well, let's hear more of your conversation with Angela Bassett.
Obviously, you're here to talk about Black Panther. I have seen the sequel twice now. I will probably see it again with my family over the holidays. I loved it. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, good. Yeah. I've only seen it once, and that was at the premiere. So I know I missed something. You know, I got to see it again. So I'm going to see it this weekend.
Yeah. I'm curious if there was a scene that you were most excited to see come to life, especially now that you can talk about the things that happen in the film.
No, I was excited just to see the whole of it. You know, having started from the beginning, the first scene, the first week was the UN scene. So of course you're nervous and excited to see that, because that sort of sets you off on the journey, and you hope that you have established what it was that you're trying to do. That the character is present, that you get it, that now she's queen and sovereign and she is aware, and she must put these various entities, make them aware, put them in their place, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So just a lot of things going on in that moment, and you hope that that everything had been set up, and that as an actor, as a performer, that I deliver in that moment, because from there, you know, the story takes off.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. But you kind of touched on something that I wanted to start with, which, you know, I wanted to talk about process as an actor, because obviously Queen Ramonda is a character you've played before, but her life is radically different in the sequel. You know, she's lost her son. Wakanda is no longer a secret nation. And I'm just curious for you, as you were preparing to play her again, as an actor, What were you thinking that you might have to shift either physically or emotionally in order to play her again in this new phase of her life?
I think in the first one, she was more, step back, allow her kids to actualize, to be king, to be smart. They had that, just a confidence, in the way things had been all along. As you say, it's a nation that, was on the down low. No one knew about them. So there was just an ease about living. In this one, within and without, there are lots of factors that amped up the tension and the drama. She has to be more mother, than she was before. She has to be more sovereign than she was before. She has to be wiser than she was before. She has to take care of business, whereas you allow your son to, So all those things you're considering as you go through the script and how it's different, how she has to be stronger and wiser and gentler. Sometimes in gentleness is where the greatest strength emerges from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is such a duality to her in that, gentleness is the perfect word for it. And I know, just speaking of, you mentioned the UN scene, having to be more sovereign, more powerful. I know in another interview, you compared this film to more akin to theater acting, because there are some really big, powerful scenes. And, your career began in theater. You know the stage. I was curious if there were any elements of performing on the stage that you really drew upon for this film.
On the stage, we always talk about you have to hit the back row and you use all of you. You don't use just your voice. With film, the microphone is right here in your shirt, right at your shirt collar, right at the button. And so you can be, you attempt to be intimate, you can be more intimate, but the back row wouldn't be able to see that in the theater, see it or feel it. So you have to use the entirety of your body because that's the instrument. So you use the whole of the instrument, the voice, the diaphragm, the body, the walk, the stoop, the whatever it might be to get the, get across the intention or the objective. The costumes were so helpful. They made me feel powerful, whether it's the color red or whether it was the sleeves that were so regal and what they did when I turned around, when you would whirl or turn to look pronounced to the entire room. Sometimes you feel constricted, in certain moments on television or screen, it's just too big. But you had the whole of the room to work with and to use your voice and your command and your power.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the costumes. Ruth Carter did a phenomenal job, as she always does, but there was something that she said at another screening of the film. She said, when Angela comes to a fitting, she's prepared. And there was a lot of weight on the word prepared. And she said that sometimes you slip into character once you put the costumes on, you become the queen. Is that an intentional thing or does something just kind of take over once you're in costume? Because,
I'm getting up every day. I'm putting on my sweats and my workout fog and I'm doing that. You don't really look too queenly. My sweatsuit, my hoodies or whatever, and that's it. And then it's the end of the day, and then it's PJs or whatever. But I know that when I came into her domain, I'm excited about how she sees me. And I know she's brilliant, and I know she's a genius, and history can tell you so, because we got the first one. So I know she's going to take it up another notch. And it's as soon as I put on the costume, and she has a huge mirror there, and able to look at yourself, and you're able to, check your posture, how do you hold your head, your hands, your feet, you're able to, I guess, consciously critique yourself a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ask, Do I believe it? Yeah, I do. I believe that I, and then you can forget that. And when you're on the set, you can forget all about that and just go to work.
I love that. Yeah. I'm curious if you came to her with like questions, ideas, suggestions, just because of the way that she talked about you coming prepared for these fittings.
I mean, she is totally and utterly prepared. There was one moment that I thought, and you know, since I've done five movies with Ruth, you know, we have this history, which is youth, you know, and sisterhood. So, you know, we feel very comfortable with each other. I mean, we go back to what's Malcolm X and what's love, and, you know, and all this, you know, these various projects. And, you know, once I see where she's going, then it's like, okay, I get it. And she'll have all of the rings and the adornments out. So I just start to play with them to see what feels most aligned, you know? And so, and she allows that. And there was one scene which was a little challenging because we had to go back. It wasn't the over the top grandeur of the outfit. It was the outfit, the costume, when Shuri and Ramonda go into the bush. And so she just felt that that would be something totally different. We're talking about you go back, you know, lean on tradition and you go back to the bush and you sit by the water and you sit with yourself and, you know, and you don't run away and you ground yourself in who you are, a simpler you, you know. And we had that textile and this undergarment that the colors of the earth, you know, of brown and ochre, you know, tan. And she put it on me and it was like kind of odd fitting, you know, because it like cap sleeves. It was a little odd and was like a pantsuit, but it was a little big. And then she said, okay, I'm going in my warehouse, which is a massive, massive warehouse of all these costumes. She said, I'm going to go in there and look and see if I have something, you know, something else. This is not quite right. So she left out. She left me in the room with, you know, all the lovely garments and little, you know, extra, you know, like, I think it's like a little duster or whatever hanging up there. With those colors that we're familiar with, that kente, you know, all those kind of mud clothy colors that we're familiar with. And so while she was gone, I get a chance to play messed up still. So I put that on top. I said, you know, because now I think I know how to mix textiles and mix.
You're like, I'm just going to put something together.
I'm just going to.
I know what I'm doing.
Oh, and look at these neck pieces. I'm going to put that on. And she came back in. I was like, I've got to be dressed. Just like, hi. And she was like, it works. I was like, when you win another Oscar, you must thank me. You must let me borrow it for one day. For this little bit part I did.
Wait, I love that, though. Like, she loved what you, I mean, you know your character. You knew the look. I love that.
And it tickled me so much. I mean, it was such a point of pride for me that I could put together something that this genius said, check, that works. I was like, no, you're kidding me, Ruth, please don't play with me. Like, don't play with my feelings.
I love it. Yeah, yeah. She. We're all going to be watching out for your mention in her speech.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
I wanted to talk about also Letitia Wright, who was like your main on-screen partner. She plays Shuri. She's so fantastic in this. And you both do a great job of playing these characters who are rising to this enormous challenge while also grieving While also in real life, you know, continuing the legacy of Chadwick Boseman, continuing what he created. Talk to me a bit about working with Letitia and supporting each other through this process.
She's just so lovely. And to have the opportunity to return and to continue to build, you know, to build on screen and off screen, the relationship that had started on Panther One was a real joy. And I think unnecessary. A part of me, I love to support young artists and young women. And I, every day watching her work, so proud because she's so engaged and she's so dedicated. She has her little script, her little script, this thick. It's the entire script, but somehow she's gotten it condensed to, I don't know, maybe it's about 8 inches. 4 inches.
And like a little novella or something of the script?
Wow. Yes. And I was like, well, that's brilliant. How'd you get that done? And she's keeping up with her notes, and she's meticulous about her note-taking and her observations and her conversations with Ryan and just peeling back the layers of Shuri. Joy to watch it, you know, the student in her. And then she comes to the set and she's studious. She does her thing. And in between, she has fun and laughs and sings and jokes and makes me joke, you know, and makes me light as well. So, it was good to be together because it was difficult for baby, you know, for the, I think, you know, I think you get to a mature age, you hear more and more, you know, you expect, you sense, you witness, you experience loss. But when you're young, you know, you're young forever. So it was a real blow for her, as it was for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
When you don't know, but you don't know. So I was really, really very, very extremely proud of how she comported herself and how she dealt with it and how she persevered and how she triumphed.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's such a triumph, her performance, as are like all the performances and the film itself. I mean, they say like every film is a miracle, but this is really, really extraordinary what you guys were able to pull off, knowing what you were going through as well. So, yeah, all the applause. I wanted to dive into some of the scenes as well. We talked briefly about the UN scene and the theatricality of some of the bigger scenes. You know, one standout is where Queen Ramonda is talking about how she's lost everything and it fills the room. And it's such a great scene between you and Danai Gurira as well. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about preparing for that scene, figuring out the level of emotionality that you wanted to bring to that moment.
You know, I think the preparation for that scene began, well, let's say I receive the script from Ryan, you read the script and you see it. And then there was work that began with various individuals, one being Beth, who was our dialect coach. So you're reading the script, you're reading the pages, you're seeing where you're going. And even in the reading of it, like emotion just sort of, you know, bubbles up from your stomach, just rises, and you can, you know, knowing the great loss, losing your son, losing your daughter, the excuses or whatever, and she has to do what she has to do. She has to sit her down, but you felt that it just jumped off the page. So now you begin the work of you don't want the emotion to take over and then to completely lose, you know, the technique with the dialect. So it's like emotion, passion, and technique, and they have to work together, you know? They have to play nicely together. And once you have the technique, then you can sort of forget about it and then just go with passion because you're already undergirded and supported by the technique, whether it's the dialect, you know, or whatever physicality, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So on that day, you can be free, you know, you have an opportunity to be free and you can play. And that's all you really want to do. Play with those who are with you in the scene with you. Try this way and that way and whatever, you know, just play because you're not about extreme, you know, other things.
Right. Yeah. And you have that foundation. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned reading the script. I mean, I have to ask about a spoiler alert scene, you know, the devastating realization that Queen Ramonda dies trying to protect Riri Williams. I know that you said you didn't agree originally with Ryan about that choice. Talk to me about realizing, like reading the script, realizing that's going to happen and how you eventually arrived at feeling like, okay, yes, this is the right choice.
Oh, I remember reading it and I mean, I've come to love Ramonda, you know, a dream come true to portray a queen and of this glorious land, Wakanda, to have the opportunity. And audiences come to love her much. She represents your mother. I mean, this representation is phenomenal. And so to, you know, we're gonna return to this land, you know, to this glory. Okay. Oh no. Oh no. So it was really disappointing and devastating and, you know, just mind blowing when I read that, you know, that she dies. But you know, as an actor, as an artist, as a colleague, as a contributor, as someone who in service to the story, that's what you have to come to recognize and you have to deal with, that you're in service to the story and to the vision of the director, ultimately, whether you like it or not. I think I've done maybe once before. Didn't like it then either. No. You think you're indispensable. No.
Right. That's a good margin though. Only once though. Like a handful of times. That's amazing.
But how fulfilling that when it's the outpour from the audience, you know, or the gasp from the audience when that happened, how fulfilling. It's just further cements, you know, in my mind that it was a character, a beloved character, that it was just visceral, the reaction to her death. I was sitting in the theater. It's like, oh, yeah.
Yes. I couldn't believe it was happening, but I was like, of course. But it's really powerful. Last question. You know, this is an award season podcast. Mm-hmm. There's already been articles and prognosticating that you should get an Oscar nomination because your performance is so powerful. I was just curious how it feels to know that your performance is causing so much conversation in the awards space.
I'm loving it because it's been 30 years since I've been in that space before, and being in that space is just indicative of work that you've put in, that it's recognized to this degree, because there are only spots for five. Not as if there aren't, you know, more than five that are deserving, but it's a very, you know, it's a very small number. So I'm very excited to hear that kind of talk. It's been a long time. You know, a lot of people do a lot of good work along the way every year, year to year to year. But I guess it's special when it can land in that grouping.
So now let's pivot to a different blockbuster and hear the conversation that I had with James Cameron and his cinematographer, Russell Carpenter. They reunited from having worked together on True Lies and a little movie called Titanic for Avatar: The Way of Water. And this conversation got really technical really fast. And Johanna, I don't know if you've ever interviewed a director who just like really loves to get into the details, and you have to be like, I absolutely know what all of those machines are. Have you been in this situation?
I absolutely have been in that situation. Sometimes I'm like, well, maybe that's not for me to ask more about. But sometimes I love asking nerdy questions like that. Like I interviewed Alejandro Iñárritu about Bardo.
Oh, yeah.
And Darius Kondry, the cinematographer. And they got really into the weeds on all the camera techniques and stuff that they did. But I loved it. They were so passionate about it. So
that's the thing. It's, you know, directors do a lot of interviews talking about the story. But when you get them with their cinematographers, which we do in the Shot List series, which this interview will be part of as well, they just really dig in deep and they tell stories and they remember being on set together. It like unlocks a whole different part of their brain. So mm-hmm. I think it is worth keeping up with the lingo. And I kind of did my best to keep up myself and hopefully help the listeners keep up and just get insight into, I mean, how they make Avatar The Way of Water. Like these Avatar movies are complicated and digital, but also physical. I mean, there's a part in the interview where I just say, okay, so are there real lights or are they all in the computer? And the answer is both, of course. And I thought it was really interesting that I'm talking about Spider, the human character played by Jack Champion, who's kind of hanging out with all these Na'vi kids. And he is much more in the movie than the humans are throughout most of the first Avatar. You know, in the first one, you get the humans together and the Na'vi together. And Spider is with the Na'vi all the time. And shooting him was just insanely complicated, as you might imagine. But you can kind of tell they relished the challenge, too.
Katie, have you interviewed James Cameron a bunch, or was this kind of like a first big landmark interview with him?
This was a first big landmark interview, and I'd like try to be cool about it. At the beginning, I was like, is it okay to call you Jim? Because that's what people call you, but I like don't want to be too familiar.
What did he say?
Yeah, it's the loving James Cameron movies has been a major part of my life as a film fan. So that was obviously very exciting. And he was really lovely to talk to. And I think, again, because he had Russell Carpenter, who he knows so well, on the line there together to really dive deep. So it was a thrill for me. And you can hear all about it in this conversation with James Cameron and Russell Carpenter. So the work on an Avatar movie, obviously, production means something different than it does on an average movie because the process is long, there's technology. But for the two of you, when does your work together really start on this movie? And what does the start of your work together look like?
The first work together were some tests that we shot together. And then
casting.
Yeah, for casting. Yeah.
Ostensibly for casting, but we were really testing our spanking new Cine Alta camera system, too.
Yeah. And I'm very happy about that. That went well. And then I got the call to join the production. And way back in 2018, I started a year before cameras actually rolled on live action.
So what's happening in 2018 then before live action starts? What's that work?
I was doing lighting on virtual scenes. And for me, that was a new experience. But after a couple of days, I felt like I could ride the bike. I had lots of people, lots of lovely lighting designers to supervise. And we started right in. Jim said, okay, here's your scene. Go light this. And Jim's working the cameras. He's the virtual camera down in the studio. He was doing that. And then we would work upstairs. And then I'd come and show him what I did, basically. And so we just had this back and forth. And it starts also, every scene that I do on the movie starts with a conversation with Jim. If it's about an eclipse scene, Jim would tell me basically, you know, the cosmology of what, like the planet Polyphemus was composed of and what he would expect based on the gases that surround the planet. Yeah, well, when he based on the gases, and he knew the gases, what he would, the color shift that he would expect to see. So I just have all this information in my pocket now to go ahead and make these things happen. I mean, it was like that for so many things. I mean, everything really started with a conversation and then you take it from there, and
Russ and I have a shorthand from Titanic. It goes back to True Lies, but Titanic, and you know we're going after an aesthetic. You know, what's our color palette? What are we trying to say to the audience subliminally? You know, is it bright? Is it cool? Is it dark? Is it moody? Is it glorious? Is it luminous? You know, and there was some color palette stuff that was worked out on the first movie. Which Russ didn't work on. So part of it, I think, Russ, for you, part of it was just a learning curve of seeing what had worked the first time and then where to take it and move forward from there.
Yeah, I inherited a color palette for, well, for say for the jungles in Pandora, and Jim was very specific. He said, "This is a movie that's going to have a wide bandwidth of colors." And so he talked extensively about the color palettes that you would find in the jungle, and how you might have a slightly warm top light, then the canopy is very cool in between, but also spotting the landscape of the jungle with the light that comes off the plants when sunlight hits it. And it was really a beautiful way of actually lighting the Na'vi characters, because their blue skin took this green in a very, very beautiful way.
Mm-hmm. And Spider was a bit of a challenge because he had a much warmer kind of, you know, pink, orange, brown kind of skin color. And he had to blend in and be part of the scene with the others. And Russ did a lot. You sent me that picture a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
Of one of those early camera tests with that very strong cyan, blue, green LUT
right
on it, which was, I mean, we just applied that throughout, all the way through.
Yeah, it was, you know, but every place had its had a color scheme. I mean, and notes, always notes. I lit the high camp scene where the Na'vi's return after a raid, and that's a very wonderful. I mean, we talked about where the light was coming from, what the fires would look like inside the tent, and this very beautiful scene. But also, because this is an environment that is part Na'vi, but is also somewhat influenced by the technology of, what was it, the biolabs?
Biolab, the human guys, the Avatar, Project Avatar people that were there. So you created a mix of light. You had a lot of blue edge light, as I recall. I think we used the metaphor of a safe way of working.
Lovely because we, you know, there's this beautiful actually conversation between Anton, Tiri and Sully about, and they're just outside the tent. So you've got this beautiful blue light that's influenced by some of the lights that the, our good humans brought to that area. But then also that plays off the warmth of the fire. So Jim's always working out a way to get a lot of color spectrum into his scenes.
Yeah, that high camp scene in particular felt like it could be in like an old Western or something, like having the campfire at the end of the day. And I don't know how often you like look at previous films because so much of this is brand new, but was that maybe a scene where you said we're capturing the same kind of light you see in, you know, Last of the Mohicans or something like that? Are there any references like that for you guys?
Sure.
But also for me, Jim, he wanted me also to look at art. I talked about this a little bit. He said, go look at what Maxfield Parrish does with the light at the end of the day. And I don't know if you've seen his work, but it's so beautiful. All these blue and pink or blue and gold hues in it. So his references to art like that really gave me a way to go. You know, yeah. I look at that. I'd have my visual palette in mind now.
Well, I wanted to ask about Spider too, because to my mind, there's a lot more interaction between Na'vi and human in this one, and particularly in environments like in the jungle. And Spider's a major character, but you know, all throughout. So, what was the challenge this time of like making those fit together, like in terms of cinematography, or is it much easier than I'm imagining because of the way the motion capture works?
Hideously difficult, wouldn't you say, Russ?
I would say painstakingly difficult.
Okay.
Because he was in so many scenes in so many different environments. You really have to, you know, nail down exactly when and where and how the light is, and maybe where shafts of sunlight are hitting. If any of those cues are off, the audience goes, wait, something's out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
And so we worked really, really hard.
The beauty was we got to do it twice. Everything that we did with Jack photographically, we did previously with him in terms of capture. So Jack did his entire performance twice. Once for all the other actors like Sigourney and Britton and Sam, so that he was there kind of off camera. And then we had these capture scenes. And then Russ would light the capture scene. And we'd say, okay, you know, there's a bit of purple light coming from the tank over there, the amnio tank, and there's a kind of a cyan, slightly cyan kind of fluorescent light. And then there's screen lights or whatever. Russ would just fool around with that. I think when you first lit the biolab for me, I thought, boom, that's it. That's the whole color palette for that.
Oh, I had a lovely palette. I mean, I had a lovely reference, which is, you know, of course, I really studiously looked at the first film. And I knew that there would be sets that we would come back that you'd want the audience to be totally familiar with. It's like a homecoming from the first picture.
Right.
And, you know, we worked hard to, you know, make sure that the blue that was coming from the amnio tank was just as it was done in the previous picture. So I've been here. I understand what this is.
So then we'd take that capture. I would do kind of rough cameras on it, and then I'd cut the scene together, and then we'd go into live action and we'd say, okay, shot number four. We actually took my handheld move with the virtual camera and we programmed the techno dolly with that move. Or sometimes the camera operators on set would just match the move with a dolly or something like that. And so we'd kind of start with a game plan and a lighting plan. So then Russ would come in and work with his gaffer, Len, and they create a very complicated grid that allowed a lot of flexibility. And they could very quickly reproduce the lighting because we were working in a suite of lighting tools called Gazebo that we developed. After the first Avatar, we realized the CG lighting was horrible for us in our proxy environment, which we call Mobu, you know, Motion Builder. And so we built this whole suite of tools called Gazebo. And then Russ worked in Gazebo. And then when we did our simulcam, where, you know, I've now got a live action camera and actors and some set pieces, and it's all extended by simulcam. So what I'm looking at is kind of the finished shot, a proxy of the finished shot, where everything's there. Maybe it could be a giant landscape, it could be the jungle, it could be a lab space or whatever the scene is. I'm actually seeing it, and I'm seeing all the CG characters in it. And Weta had worked with our technical team to build this thing called real-time depth, and that allowed CG characters and live-action characters to move around each other without requiring alphas. It was done entirely volumetrically. It was quite remarkable.
Wait, so what's alphas?
Well, an alpha is like a holdout mat. So typically that would be done in the past with a blue screen.
Okay,
using a blue screen or a green screen. It was done volumetrically. So wherever that CG character was, that's where he was spatially.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So he could actually pass in front of an actor. It would render out that way in real time. And then I could operate the camera to that. So the beauty of that is Russ had the lighting from that he'd done previously, and then he had to sort of match it, or we could change it. In other words, Russ, you could change the lighting however we wanted. We could change the lighting, and then we'd back the lighting changes into the live action version of Gazebo. So we were kind of working in two worlds simultaneously. This is kind of a bit of a mind, you know.
It's a rather permeable wall between the live action and what's done virtually. And of course I had these wonderful references all the information that I did in the virtual world, I could access 2.5 years later,
mm-hmm.
you know, by talking with my lovely friends and the over on the computer side who were quite helpful.
Well, we'd have it would look like Mission Control in the backfield, you know, behind us. It's like we just pull the curtain across so we don't have to see all the people back there. You know?
And it really was, I have to say, my duties in lighting were what they'd be on a live action picture. The experience of making the film when we were shooting live action was so alien to how I worked in the past. I mean, there's a lot of incantations and setups that have to go on.
A lot of voodoo.
Because Jim, the live camera with what Jim did years ago with his virtual camera. But however, once that's done, once that fusion has been made, there's a lot of freedom because Jim could hand hold the camera, which he often did. He wanted to be right with the actors. And, you know, he could totally, you're not locked into some absolute. I mean, there's a lot of room for making a change. And Jim will often make changes in framing just based on what's going on in front of his eyes.
The thing is that, you know, Russ and I have worked together so much, we're kind of like an old married couple. And there's a great dialogue, and you know, he might get excited about an idea and pitch it to me, or I might get excited about an idea and pitch it to him. And there's a lot of flexibility, but however I'm moving that camera around, whether it's with the crane or a dolly or hand-holding, the world is just changing accordingly. Mm-hmm. I can walk through that virtual world. I can walk through the physical world with the set pieces. We never built everything. We just built what we needed. And so, you know, we had kind of infinite ability to reimagine the scene if we got interested in something in the moment. And Russ is very intuitive about his approach to lighting and color and feeling. You know, I would say Russ's greatest gift as a cinematographer is that it's a feeling. It's an aesthetic feeling, you know, that he brings to it. And I get kind of up in my head technically, and he kind of always grounds me with, you know, what are we trying to say here? What's our mood?
I want to make sure I've got just the logistics right. So physically in the space where you have the actors, you're moving the camera around. Have you set up lights there that are part of the cinematography, or are they just lights to work and all of the lighting that we actually see in the movie is what's been done digitally?
No. Well, so there's that which we are photographing live, mm-hmm. which sometimes can be the most of the frame, or it can even be only a small part of the foreground. But whatever you're doing to light that live set and the actors now becomes your lighting and has to be propagated back into the CG portion of it, you know, when it all goes to Weta. So we do a kind of a proxy lighting pass to get us in the ballpark. And then Russ lights it, and then that lighting becomes definitive, and then that dictates all the downstream version of the lighting. We have a little bit of wiggle room, but not that much. You know, so the key fill ratios on Spider become critical, or any of the characters, because that we can't change once it's baked in at that moment.
I was really surprised. Is that I thought, oh, you're going to be totally locked in, and yet there's room to move, and there's room to move in post to seal the deal in terms of how seamless this photography is, or how well embedded does Spider look in this virtual world. And I thought it was successful.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as the regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after the regime airs.
I feel like we have to talk about sunlight because it's part of the script. You've got Eclipse kind of added as this factor in the story. And then it's such a huge element when you get out to the reef cultures. And yeah, there is sunlight in the original Avatar, but it's just so much more prominent in this. So why was adding the sun part of the story? And is it because technology advanced in a way to make the sun work better this time around than in the first one?
What did you use for your main sun elements, Russ? I can't
remember. Well, it really depended. We ran out of space on that huge set where the sea dragon was. So we worked with one very strong element, like it's called an Arimax, basically. But then we had other elements that seemed to, you have to make it all look like one sun. But then we had other lights kind of clustered around that, and they would make strategic strikes. So in that sense, when you're on the studio, and we were on the studio every day. We never went outside. But it was just part of the logistics. We're just finding the space to get your light back far enough to make a very convincing sun.
Now, the sea dragon, is that the ship, or are we talking about one of the creatures?
Yeah, that's the ship that opens like a big clamshell.
I was like, this is the biggest thing in the movie. So
yeah, right. Sense. So the sun was important because, you know, what there are many flavors of sun. And Russ and I had big discussions about, you know, how late in the day are we? You know, what's our key fill ratio and what's our color dynamic in from the key side to the fill side? You know, so if you're midday, there's not much of a color dynamic. You get a little bit of blue in the sky. But if you're late day, it really pulls apart by thousands of degrees Kelvin, you know. And so we'd have long discussions about that. And we could actually preview it in Gazebo. We could see how warm we wanted the Sun key in gazebo, like right in the live composite in the shot, and then we could Russ could propose something, and then they could match it in gazebo or vice versa, because we use simulcam for just about everything. Because mm-hmm. We wanted to compose to what the final shot would kind of look like. I don't think there are any shots that aren't in the final cut of the movie. There are no shots that aren't VFX shots.
I mean, you've got the sun going down over the course of the last hour. You've got the large scale, sequence with the Tolkien that's kind of in like very broad, straight up daylight. But then the sun is starting to go down over the course of it. And Obviously you're storyboarding something to this extent. But Like how do you work with the amount of elements that you have in keeping track of the sun, and why build the sun into the story, into the final hour in that way?
I think, Russ, didn't we pretty much figure out our sun angles in virtual first?
Yep. At the whale hunt, we definitely talked about where that sun was, where it was coming from, and what that would look like. And then there was a lot of discussions that because of the eclipse, things get a lot more dramatic mm-hmm. on the Sea Dragon. And as the Sea Dragon is attacked by the Na'vi and the Metkayina, mostly the Na'vi, and a very angry mom, having it dark at that time made for a much more dramatic theater of operations in terms of fire and lighting and of course, explosions and all that.
Yeah, we pulled out every trick we could for color, even having some of the lights on the ship submerge below the water and then come up through it in this kind of cyan. So we're mixing cyan, firelight, yellow rotator emergency beacons flashing across faces. And all that had to be integrated across, again, the set extensions and all that. So we always had to figure out where everything was really supposed to be. And we just always made the assumption that the eye had enough time to kind of follow where things were supposed to be. But we took a lot of liberties.
Well, that's interesting, because when you have a world that's so full and so the technology is so novel, like knowing that what the audience has time to follow and what we need more time for, how do you figure that out? Because it works. High frame rate helps with that also. But mm-hmm. where do you kind of judge what the audience can keep up with and what maybe needs another second or another few frames for us to understand?
That's the trickiest part, because part of the fun of an Avatar movie is that it does slow down and let you smell the roses and be in the space and feel present. But you also have to maintain a narrative momentum. So different scenes had different cutting rhythms. I think the Tulkun hunt was cut pretty quickly. But even within that, kind of motif, instead of, when other movies are cut quickly, they're on about a 1 second cutting rhythm in an action sequence. We'd be more like 2 seconds. Give you a little more time to take it in, just a little bit more, but still maintain forward momentum. But in general, I think on Titanic, we found that we were cutting at about 1/3 the rate of a typical big movie. Wow. And on Avatar, we were cutting at about 1.75, the rate. So not quite half the speed.
Wow.
I mean, we actually did a study of this, cadence, rhythm, from an editing standpoint. But in general, we wanted to hang on shots longer and develop shots that played. I always said that to really service 3D well, you try to make one shot do the job of two in a normal movie. So that you get to hang a little longer in one perspective or one bit of space.
The shot that kind of sums up the movie in some ways to me, and speaking of lingering, is where you've got Nowak kind of touching the Tolkien, like the from below, you've got the sun shining above them. It's so specific. It's been in a lot of the advertising. Can you guys just talk about that shot specifically, how that's made, how that comes together, and how you decided on that look for it?
Oh, we captured that in the tank with Loak holding his hand out and touching. I think he was just touching the hand of the guy that played Biacon, or it might have been a piece of pipe. I don't remember, but he was touching something and just floating, and he had to stabilize his buoyancy and look up to where he imagined the eye to be. I mean, Biacon was an unusual character because he was so big he couldn't be played by a puppeteer. So, and then we went into, the lighting format in virtual. This was after young Britton Dalton, who played Loak, has already gone home and the tank's been torn down. And then we figure out what looks good, and you move the sun around. The beauty of it is you can just drag the sun all over the place till you see what looks good. And we could do that on the live action set as well. Let's move the sun a little bit more. Let's move it some more. Oh, that was great. Okay, good. All right. Now let's match that. So, yeah. So we did find an interesting wrinkle, though. You put the sun where you want it in the gazebo tool set, and then Weta takes it. And then Weta will actually do proper ray trace refraction through a real water surface. And guess what? The sun's not there anymore. The sun's now out of frame.
Oh,
right?
Wow.
It's like, hey, because, you know, we're faking it a little bit in gazebo. We don't do proper refractive ray tracing. So you know, my answer to them was simple. No, the sun goes there. You guys figure it out.
The fun thing for me, I walked over to the gym, had this huge tank built inside a very large studio. And the tank made it possible to do so many different scenarios. It was like a Swiss Army knife. You could have a shallow shore. You could have a very deep environment. But I walked over one day and something was happening. And I was going, this woman was swimming around almost in circles and the cameras were below looking up at her. And I said, what's that supposed to be? And I think it was Garrett Warren said, oh, she's a whale today.
Yeah, we wanted the gesture. Yeah. We wanted the gesture. So we put the, you know, having a human performer, we got them to swim like Tulkun. We gave them monofins and so on. And then, you know, if they wanted to interact, they could hold out a hand and they could touch fins, or they could shelter a calf, or they could swim in tandem, or they could hang vertically in the water. We wanted to get the social vocabulary of the Tulkun, and so we just asked our water performers to do it. But Rush, remember that the hoops we had to jump through in that tank to light Spider with the bioluminescence for movie 3 and for, you know, all the different setups. You had to pull tools out of, you know, I mean, things that I had never seen before.
Yeah, luckily, in the years between Avatar 1 and The Way of Water, lighting tools have changed a lot. And it's now quite possible for us to have remotely controlled lights under the water. And we could simulate kind of any, I mean, basically there are tubes, but we could simulate so many kinds of bioluminescence, or if somebody's walking through shallow water and say, Jim, if you watch The Abyss or, you know, any of the water movies, he loves the life that light from coming up from below gives to the scene. And so then if we've got all this plant life underneath, there's another excuse to use that motif.
Yeah.
But yeah, the problem with lighting for Spider, though, is that he's wearing a mask. And we jumped through a few hoops because anytime you put up any kind of light, you see it in the mask. And I think Dan Cox and Jim worked on basically changing how that mask bent and how it was shaped just to help us.
We put a bit of a curve on it. What we found out, which is very counterintuitive, if you're illuminating what's supposed to be bioluminescence, you typically would want to spread that light and make it as soft and broad as possible. You might even bounce into a submerged Griflon or something like that, or you'd use big panels or tubes. And what we found was then your reflection just covered his whole face. So we actually found out the best thing to do was to use one light to do it. Hmm. And then you get a point source reflecting, and you could paint that out. So the reflection in the mask wouldn't be broad. It would be very tiny. And sometimes just by getting Jack to turn his head, we could get him to put it right on the corner of the lens, meaning the lens of the mask. And then we could paint it out later. But that's kind of counterintuitive, and that took a lot of testing. Our workaround when people were above water was we just shot with no glass in the mask.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was way too time consuming. I mean, you could see what my glasses are doing just here, you know.
It's like the oldest trick in the book, right? Isn't that what all TV shows do? Just everyone's glasses are
it's
empty?
It's the oldest trick in the book, but it gets a bit daunting when you've got 1,000 mask shots that have to run through CG later, you know.
True.
But it did give us a lot of flexibility. And Russ also worked out with his team a way to run fiber optic up into the mask to create a little bit of illumination on Jack's face that corresponded to this kind of HUD display, like the mask had a head-up display inside it. And that was even true underwater. We had to figure out how to do that underwater. All coming back now, right, Rez?
Yeah. No, it was like, so Jim, you know, throws out the challenge. Okay, this is what I want. This is what it's got to look like. And this is what it's got to do. And you're thinking, how hard can that be? And I think 4 months later, we were still working on how to get this point source in the mass as tiny as we can get it and do the things that Jim wanted it to do. So it's always
like flash, like when it turned amber and turned into an alarm and then turned red. And there's things that we developed that had story requirements across movie two and movie three. So we haven't seen some of that stuff. You know, we tried to do a one size fits all development pathway.
Yeah. I think I'm going to run out of time, but maybe a last question for you guys. I think of you in the water tanks. I think about Titanic, of course, and there's a lot of shots in this that, you know, bring Titanic to mind. And you're doing something that's totally different from it. I am assuming you've got more freedom than when you're in a physical tank with physical people and physical light. So what was that comparison like for you two? Did you think about Titanic at all as you went back into the tanks together?
I don't think we thought about Titanic that much, but we did have two completely discrete sets of problems. One was the doing in the capture tank. But the other one was the tanks in New Zealand for live action. And I think the biggest challenge Russ had, which, Russ, you can explain how you did it. When we're shooting Spider at the surface of the water and there's fire all around, we need to get that fire reflecting in the water. So in the old days, you would have done it with big propane burners and stuff like that. But Russ used big LED screens. So it got us closer to that kind of virtual production that people are talking about now, where they use massive LED arrays.
LED screens, if you shoot them with a stereo movie or a 3D movie, what you get is what looks just like a billboard. It's two-dimensional. But we found that we could use these LEDs in really much more efficient ways, especially when we were shooting in the water. And there's supposed to be these huge oil fires around. That would be a hard thing for visual effects to do, to make all those reflections in the water. I mean, it's moving constantly. So we just said, let's just blanket this area with these LED screens that have basically the fire that you're supposed to be seeing, and hang them either just above the water or figure out a way using mirrors to have the fire appear to come right out of the water. And that actually helped wet out quite a bit. And it was,
Yeah, we'd have big banks of plexiglass mirrors. And we'd be reflecting screens so that it looked like the fire was right at water level. And then we'd just put the camera kind of right at water level because the mirrors would come right down to the water.
Yeah, we couldn't get those LED screens too low, or it would be a very expensive shooting day.
and short out, right?
Yeah, everything would just short out. So, yes, this mirror gag, the big LED panels were lying flat, shooting down into a 45-degree plexiglass mirror. And, of course, the bottom of the mirror could be right in the water and no harm, no foul. And that's how we did that.
And now that's for shots with Spider, or is that for all of them, and Weta is adapting it to for all of the shots that involve the fire in the water?
Any human care, we really pretty much mostly just had Spider in the water. There were a couple scenes we shot that got cut out of the movie that had other characters in the water. But it was pretty much Spider, because if it was a CG character like Kiri in the water or Jake, then they just rendered CG water. Mm-hmm. But the tricky part was when you had Spider and two CG characters in the same shot, then they had to figure out how to do a complicated split screen and extend out not only the water, but the color and intensity of the reflections that Russ had created. So Weta had to take and build on what we had built into the plate. But our philosophy was the more we do real, the better. And then let them sort out downstream where they want to replace something or blend into it.
I love that split screen is still around. Talk about oldest trick in the book. Like that is such a classic format, but it's still part of it.
Yeah, but it wasn't like just that split screen. It was like finding a wave and rotoing the edge of that wave and then matching the CG water to it beyond that. It's a pretty complicated split screen. So, you know, it took them months to do it. But, you know, you just know when you're doing this kind of movie that everything's going to take time, and it's going to take testing, R&D, and, you know, the creativity of a whole bunch of people.
That does it for today's interview episode. Happy New Year, everybody. We'll be back on Thursday with our regular roundtable conversation. In the meantime, find us on Twitter at HWD and on our own. I am at Katie Rich and Johanna.
I'm at Johanna Desta.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.